shake my nerves and you rattle my brain. Too much love drives a man insane. You broke my will, but what a thrill. Goodness gracious, great balls of fire.
You know, that'd make a great name for a pay-per-view. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. That would never happen. Wait, what?
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
You fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
We now know when Brock Lesnar's first Universal title defense will be. Sunday, July 9th is the date, 3 months after winning it, at a brand new Raw pay-per-view called WWE Great Balls of Fire. The idea that Michael Cole will be forced to talk about Great Balls of Fire in a very excited way over and over and over again has to be some kind of rib on the announcers. It just has to be. That is a real pay-per-view name. I am not making that up. It is all very legit. I'm trying to think back in my memory bank to find a worse pay-per-view name. I remember Fatal 4-Way, many years ago. That was a terrible idea. Thankfully, that only lasted one pay-per-view. In Your House, let's be honest here. I mean, there were a lot of good In Your House shows, but In Your House was a pretty bad name. Taboo Tuesday, that was another bad one. Fastlane, honestly, Fastlane is also pretty terrible. So there have been some bad ones. I don't think there's ever been one worse than this. This one takes the cake. It's one hell of a publicity stunt, I'll give them that. This is all anybody's been talking about the past few days. It's this crappy pay-per-view name. But, maybe at the show they'll hand out flaming beach balls to the fans. You watch how fast that trend comes to an end. And then we can get an in-depth post-show called Balls Deep with Renee Young. That'll be fun. This is episode 493 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, April 30th, 2017. I am the Solid Monster. We set our all-time Audible record for most sign-ups in a month here in April, thanks to you guys. Cashing in on the AJ Lee book, Crazy is My Superpower. You still have time to get your copy free, courtesy of the Sound Off. The book is narrated by AJ herself. Just sign up with audibletrial.com/solidmonster and try the service out for 30 days. If you cancel for any reason before those 30 days are up, you get to keep your free book no matter what. It does not have to be the AJ book either, guys. I mean, you want a non-wrestling book? Someone the other day just tweeted me a photo of a LeBron James book that they got called Return of the King. So if you want that, boom, it's yours. You've got tons and tons and tons of titles to choose from, over 180,000. So, and also, keep in mind, I want to mention this here. Jim Ross has a new book coming out this October. And this is a book that's been a long time in the making. I'm sure it's the first of many. Jim Ross has been around for a long, long time. He's got a lot of stories to tell. One of the greatest minds in the business, the greatest announcer of all time. And he has a book coming out in October. He's also announced that he is going to be narrating the audio version. So if you want to show your support for the podcast, I know it's several months down the road, but keep that in mind. That'd be a hell of a way to do that once that book comes out, because that's going to be a big one. The Justin Roberts book, a lot of you guys have been asking me about that as well. It should be hitting the Audible store any day now. I know Justin himself has been tweeting. He has no idea. He's also kind of frustrated, been waiting for it to come out. So as soon as it does, I'll let you guys know if you want to keep checking on your own. I've not finished his book yet, by the way. I had bought the Kindle version. What I've read so far, though, is really good. And once I'm done with it, I may try to get him on the show. So audibletrial.com/solidmonster. You guys killed it this month, and we still have however many hours are left today as I'm recording this. So if you want to sign up here for the month of April, you may do so. You want to become a PayPal VIP, you can do that very easily on thesolidmonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out here on the show as we do roll call here. My favorite tag team, John Loose Cannon Lopez and Deadpool James Herrera. See, that's one team. Hopefully they don't turn on each other one day. Because then I lose out. So as long as they stay together, those guys have become good friends. I'm very happy to see that. So thank you to both of them for donating. Beast Mode Brock Joseph. Out of Control Cody Thomas. The Florida Freebird Bryant Becerra. Jerome, You're Going Down Eugenio. Damn Straight Michael Dorsey. Matt Slap My Patoot Silly Scala. I don't know the significance of that name, but that's the name he wanted. And so there you go. Kind of a Big Deal, Corey Blake, Nemesis Nathan Moyers, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Mass Grave Micah Harshaw, The Prince of Pleasantville, Anelio Crockett, Nicholas the Devious DeSimone, Sean Nasty Boy Nilsson, Capital Carnage, Christian Reyes, The Black Menace, Karsten Axe, Rude Dude, Robert Maletta, Billy Hardcore Habibi, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, Real Rock and Roller Ryan Hodge, The Brooklyn Bombers, Jamel and Isaiah Walker, Sherrod Big Daddy Boyd. This one's from Jessica in honor of your last year together. The Model, Nicholas Benny. The Chosen Son, Andre Smith. Andre, by the way, did some digital artwork of Shinsuke Nakamura that I retweeted the other day. It looks incredible. You can check that and the rest of his work out at asfarnum.com. .artstation.com. He's a very talented dude, so go check out his portfolio there. The UK Commandos, Brian and Emily McCart. Shout out to Emily, who just added a new member to their little faction yesterday, a 6-pound, 10-ounce baby girl named Juno Agnes McCart. Very happy for the both of you, a future Sound Off fan in the making. And finally, I want to wish Simon and his wife, Shawnee, a very happy third wedding anniversary. I understand they're also expecting their first child. Lots of little babies popping up everywhere. Thankfully, none of them belong to me. But congratulations. Simon is clearly putting his great balls of fire to good use. So thank you to everybody who made a donation this week. Again, you guys support this podcast in many different ways. PayPal being the most direct, but I appreciate it all. I have a new video up on the YouTube channel. It just went up early this morning. If you did not see it, it is the latest WrestleCrate unboxing. And yes, as people suggested I do last time, I did finally go out and buy a webcam that is of at least good quality. And so if you would like to actually see, visually see the unboxing, that is now up on the YouTube channel as I dig into the crate that had the theme for the crate this past month was animals. So it's very animal themed. If you have, you know, a wrestler with an animal nickname or a gimmick, or who used to bring an animal down to the ring, there's likely an item for them in that crate. It's pretty cool. So if you want to go check that out, you may do so. Obviously, tonight is Payback on pay-per-view on the network. I'm going to be doing Payback predictions here on the show this week, but I'll do that after the Raw review. I think that makes more sense. So if you want to skip ahead or just stick around, we'll get there in due time. But those predictions for tonight are coming up. I'm also introducing a new segment to the show. We'll see how long this lasts. I'm introducing a new segment this week. This was after the feedback I got to my Global Force Wrestling funeral last week. And the feedback to that was great, by the way. I'm happy most of you, anyway, enjoyed it. But I did hear from one listener who happens to be an Impact fan, who asked me to give the show another chance. And I respect this person a lot. He's been a fan for a long time. So I watched this week, or at least I watched as much as I could tolerate. And I'm not reviewing Impact. This is not about me going back to reviewing TNA or anything like that. But we're going to try something new. It's a little segment that I'm calling Say Something Nice About Impact, where I try to find one thing I like about Impact and talk about it, because there is a lot of negativity, because there's a lot of negative things that happen, whether it's behind the scenes or what have you, and I actually have news on that later as well. So I figured, why not turn the tables a little bit, try to look at the positive side of things, and I guess the question is, was I able to do that? Was I able to find that one positive thing this week on Impact? You'll have to wait to find out. Plus, I will have my thoughts on Vince McMahon's new movie, the new Vince McMahon biopic that's coming out. It has been greenlit. It is happening. Sony has the rights. And you will not believe some of the scenes from the early screenplays of this thing. A lot of stuff that I'm sure will not make the final cut, but some of it might. And it's pretty far out there. And then we'll have a funny story also involving Vince and a bunny costume. So that's all coming up later in the podcast. As I am recording this, on a more serious note, Sean Waltman is missing. He no-showed an IPW event in the UK yesterday. This was to be his final match ever in the UK. He had gotten himself into great shape. If you remember that photo he posted not too long ago showing his abs and everything, he seemed to be in a really good place. He was scheduled to land yesterday at 2 p.m., and he never landed, and nobody has heard from him since. He hasn't tweeted anything in a few days. He's not returning any phone calls. It is entirely possible he lost his phone or something along those lines, but you would think then that he would find another way to get in touch with people just to let everybody know that he's okay. And the fact that he has yet to do so is not good. Hopefully by the time you listen to this, everything is resolved, and this is all just a moot point, but given his history, obviously you worry about stuff like this, and friends of his worry about stuff like this. So best wishes to him. Hopefully everything is okay. I'm going to get into Monday Night Raw here before we do the payback predictions, and I'm just letting you guys know, I did not like much of what I saw this week on WWE television. It's been a while since there's been a week between Raw and SmackDown, but more so Raw, where I was pretty well just disgusted by these shows. This was one of those weeks. So if you thought that Raw was just fine and dandy, you're probably not going to enjoy this review. But Raw was live from Kansas City, Missouri this past Monday night. Raw Twitter poll says it all, really. Over 2,300 votes. Only 27% thumbs up. 73% thumbs down. So I'm hardly in the minority on this. I didn't watch Raw live, which would explain why I didn't get a poll up until almost an hour after the show was over. I almost forgot. But I saw the early results coming in, and it was not very good. And I thought to myself, man, that is especially not good heading into a pay-per-view on Sunday. Then I watched the show myself, because sometimes, you know, I may disagree with what the poll says. I mean, it's rare, but it happens. So then I watched the show, and it is appropriate that they had a dumpster match on there, because that is exactly where the show belonged. This was a terrible show. Somehow, they managed to actually get me less interested in Payback, which is kind of the opposite, I think, of what they're supposed to be doing, but that's exactly what happened. They had this opening segment, which I thought was very bad. We went from the highlight reel to Miz TV to the Ambrose Asylum, all in the span of one segment. It was all comedy, pretty much. Mostly miss. Sometimes it's hit or miss. This was mostly a miss. Dean Ambrose gives Chris Jericho a brand new light jacket to replace the one he destroyed last year in their feud. This was just a regular jacket here, laced with Christmas lights. Miz was jealous that he didn't get a gift. Ambrose gave him dirty deeds. Jericho put Maryse on the list, and she threw a fit. Not exactly must-see television here. This was dreadful. And speaking of Ambrose, just to shift subjects a little bit, Renee Young gave an interview to Brides.com. She revealed some information about their recent wedding. If you remember, the news broke, they got married a few weeks ago. She said they've been together for 3 years already. They knew they wanted to have a Las Vegas wedding because apparently they live in Las Vegas. They wanted to do something very low-key, so they went and they got their marriage license about 6 months ago. And they just waited. They waited for the right moment. A few weeks ago, they're at home, they're relaxing on a random Sunday night, they're about to go to bed. All of a sudden, Dean Ambrose pulls out a ring. Great timing. He pulls out a ring, she figures at that point, well, I guess we're doing this now. And she starts searching for a 24-hour pastor on Yelp. Yelp! Lucky for her, she found a pastor named Pastor Pete, who happened to live right around the corner from them. So here they are, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. She's calling up Pistol Pete, Pastor Pete, what the hell is his name? Pastor Pete. He may have been carrying a pistol, who the hell knows? I don't know, what's the law out there in Nevada? I don't even know. I don't think you could do that in New York. I don't know, maybe you can. If it's someplace like Texas, you could probably carry around 3 shotguns and hide a hand grenade in your back pocket, and that would be a normal day. Every state is different. So anyway, they call Pastor Pete. He comes to their backyard, it's 1 a.m., he's going to officiate the ceremony. They had to get a witness also, so she had to go wake up a friend of hers in the middle of the night. And just like that, bada boom, they're husband and wife. And I read this, and it's like, if that isn't the best wrestling wedding story ever, I don't know what is. If I ever get married one day, I actually think that'd be kind of cool. Just one day, you're like, hey, You want to do it? She's like, sure. See, if you find a woman like that, who doesn't care about having the big fancy wedding with 150 people and spending all that money, and she just goes on Yelp, she goes on her phone, hey, let's find someone. She's a keeper. Matt Hardy beat Sheamus. He continues to tease being broken. He keeps posting tweets teasing that it's coming, deletion is coming. He posted one tweet. I laughed. I know I shouldn't have, but he posted a tweet. It said, the obsolete owl cannot evade my broken brilliance by flying away. Deletion is coming. And with it was a Vine video. I didn't even know Vine was still around. There was a Vine video. I don't know what the hell was going on here. It was some kind of a wedding reception or a party. And there's an owl handler. He's got an owl on his hand. He's got the glove. And all of a sudden, the owl goes flying. Now, they're indoors, right? So the owl goes flying. Everybody is just sitting around at their table. And the owl makes a beeline right for one of the windows. And I guess the owl didn't realize that there was a window there. And he slammed right into the glass. You heard this loud thud. And that's the first thud, because then he literally falls straight down. You hear the second thud as he hits the ground. I laughed my ass off. Okay, and I have a soft spot for animals and all that, and I hate animal cruelty, but I just couldn't help myself. He posted this tweet, and all I could think of course, is, you know, Rebby Skies hashtag. And here's this owl just flying into the window, and that thud, I can't get that thud out of my head. And I think by the time this whole thing is over with Anthem and everything, I think that'll be a good metaphor for how this thing really turns out in the end, with that freaking owl flying right into the window and falling straight down. As far as where things stand with that, Rebby went on Twitter. There's been a lot of rumors going around that it's a done deal. They reached a settlement and Matt's going to be broken maybe as early as tonight. Rebby went on Twitter to debunk all of the rumors that WWE reached a deal with Anthem for the gimmick. She said it's nonsense. It's ridiculous. Now, maybe she's just screwing with everybody. It is possible. It's going to happen. It doesn't matter whether it's tonight, whether it's tomorrow night, if it's a month from now. I'm not really convinced that that is settled yet, but whenever it does, it's going to happen. And I would just caution people to remember, when it happens, I mean, I would be surprised. It's not like Matt's getting it back. This is WWE that's negotiating this. It means that WWE now owns it. And then it becomes a question at that point of, do they let Matt have any real creative input into this, or do they just screw the whole thing up? Because when WWE takes possession of it, it becomes their baby, and all bets are off as far as how this turns out. Now, I do think that it's worth it for them to go ahead and do it. I want them to, but I also don't want them to screw it up, because I think they have something really entertaining there. But if they put their spin on it, all of a sudden, it becomes something very different. So, as exciting as it is that maybe we'll see this on WWE television, because the Hardys, so far, they haven't even spoken. They haven't cut any promos on TV. It's all very generic. It's the Hardy Boys reunion tour. It can't go on forever. I'm ready for them to be broken, or at least Matt. I don't know if Jeff will, but, you know, do the whole broken stuff. But I think we should all be a little cautious, because this is WWE that we're talking about here. Jeff Hardy and Cesaro were ringside for the match. They started arguing. That distracted Sheamus. He turned around, walked right into a twist of fate for the pin. You would think, with Matt and Jeff each winning their singles matches over Cesaro and Sheamus, that by WWE logic, that means that the titles are changing hands tonight. But I think it would be too early. I mean, I guess if they did get the rights to the broken stuff, they could just do the title change tonight and get on with it. But again, I find some of these stories suspect. I don't think that's a done deal yet. I'm going to say that they keep the belts and Cesaro and Sheamus go heel, because they've been showing a lot of heel tendencies. It just kind of feels like, oh, they go in for the handshake and can we trust them? And then they shake hands and everything's all cool. But you know, at some point that's going to change. So I could see the title staying with the Hardys, but then Cesaro and Sheamus going heel when the match is over. Kalisto did indeed beat Braun Strowman in the dumpster match, as I figured he would on last week's podcast, but not because of interference from Roman Reigns. They actually kept Roman off the show for a second straight week. I was very impressed. No, how they did this was, Braun Strowman is standing on the apron. Kalisto drop kicks his knees out from underneath him, and Strowman falls feet first into the dumpster. You didn't have to bother closing the lid in this match, as was the case in past dumpster matches. I guess they changed that rule. All you had to do was be thrown into one. And that was it. Strowman loses the match. Kalisto gets a win, a cheap win. You know what it reminded me of? It was very similar to, there was a match many years ago with Big Show. It was a tables match. I don't remember who he was wrestling. Big Show literally, like, stepped down from the apron and put his foot through the table. And remember he made that face like he crapped his pants or something? That's what this kind of reminded me of. It was almost like just a fluky thing. This set Strowman off. He went on a rampage. He destroyed Kalisto. He slammed him into the mat repeatedly with one hand. He threw him out of the ring. He threw him into the barricade. He threw him into the dumpster. He slammed the lid shut. He rolled it up onto the stage. And in a repeat of the angle that they did almost 20 years ago with the New Age Outlaws, he pushed the dumpster off the stage. Now, as somebody who was a fan at the time and lived through the angle with the Outlaws when they rolled Cactus Jack and Terry Funk off the stage, I remember that like it was yesterday. That was a serious angle, okay? Because everybody came out. I remember Sunny was out there. She was crying. And it was a heavy angle. And they did that as a way to get the Outlaws over as these vicious heels. And I thought it was a success. It worked at least until the end of the show when these horrific injuries that these two allegedly sustained, there they are. They're back by the end of the show. You know, we joked today about how they do an injury angle and the guy's back by the next week. At least now they've kept Roman off TV for 2 weeks, right? That night, as great as that angle was, they came back at the end of the show wearing hospital gowns attached to their, IV poles. I mean, it was completely preposterous. They just screwed the pooch on that whole thing. But I remember that being a great angle. And part of it was a pretty steep drop from the top of that Raw stage down below. I don't know exactly how many feet. It was at least, I mean, if I had to guess, it had to be every bit of 6 or 7 feet, maybe 8 feet. It was a pretty steep drop. Well, how high is that stage now, right? Like 2 feet? So maybe a 2 foot drop? Not that I want, you know, poor Kalisto to get killed, but if you're going to do this angle, you know, and I guess it's been almost 20 years. I mean, we were just talking about the ring break, the ring collapse. They've done 3 of those since 2003, and I thought it was okay. I mean, enough time has gone by. So it's been a long time since they've done this, but as somebody who remembers the original, to see this was obviously very underwhelming. If you're a new fan or a little kid, this was probably, you know, an unbelievable thing to witness, this little guy getting pushed off the stage. To me, I just thought it was underwhelming. And if you're going to repeat an angle from many years ago, at least try to do it better. Don't do it worse. This was worse. This was inferior. So anyway, that part was really lame. I do enjoy watching crazed, maniacal Braun. That's always fun to watch. In fact, that's one of the few things that I think is worth watching on the show at the moment each week. I mentioned Roman Reigns. May as well talk about this here. How about that Roman Reigns video package, huh? All those cheering fans that mysteriously replaced all the boos and all the middle fingers from Orlando that night after WrestleMania. It's almost like it never happened. It was like a dream. That may have been the most blatant video editing since the 92 Rumble one, where they tried to make it sound like the crowd was booing Sid after he dumped Hogan out of the ring, which of course they weren't. They cheered him. So later in the show, again, Roman wasn't there, you know, physically, but later in the show, they showed us quotes on the screen from a WWE.com interview that Roman did, which was just bizarre. They went in and out of kayfabe. First, they had him talking about his brother's death. You know, Rosie just passed away last week. He talked about that and how tough it's been for him and his only brother. And then they just go right into his fake injuries at the hands of Braun Strowman. And my week was that much worse because of the injuries I sustained at, you know, from Braun. I mean, look, you can't ignore the fact that the guy's brother died. You kind of have to mention it, but it's just weird the way they went in and out of kayfabe mode. It's like that's part of the storyline now. I mean, we'll see if they mention it tonight at the pay-per-view. I would not be surprised if they brought it up and they said, man, you know, it's been a tough couple of weeks for Roman. He lost his brother. He got hurt by Braun. Can he come back tonight? Can he have a big comeback performance? And it's like, well, you know, in wrestling, I'm all for incorporating real life events into things and making things a little more realistic. You can't really ignore the fact that the guy's brother died, especially since the brother worked for WWE before, for God's sakes. I just said to myself, it's just weird to go from one to the other like that, in and out. I don't know. It just was very weird. But Bray Wyatt, speaking of weird, Bray did another spooky video talking about the House of Horrors. If you've seen one of these, you've seen them all. Bray is like a villain right out of a Looney Tunes cartoon. You know, all talk, no payoff. I actually do think he's going to win tonight. I guess I'll give away one of my predictions here. I think Bray is going to win the House of Horrors match, but that would buck the usual pattern with this guy. I mean, he's like Wile E. Coyote, right? He comes up with all these clever plots, you know, but the Roadrunner ends up kicking his ass in the end. It doesn't matter what he does. It doesn't matter what he says. In the end, he's always losing. So, you know, I bet you that Matthew, okay, from Botchamania or somebody could put together a pretty funny video of all these Bray Wyatt interview clips and just clips from all these Bray Wyatt, like, go-home promos before big matches. Him saying all this scary, serious, spooky stuff. And then at the end of each clip, you splice in a clip of him being pinned and beaten in the payoff match, in the pay-per-view match. You could probably come up with at least 5 or 6 different examples of this over the last 3 or 4 years. I bet you somebody could put that together. I think it'd be pretty funny to watch. Not for Bray, it wouldn't be, but it'd be pretty funny to watch. Dana Brooke had a match with Alicia Fox. Holy mother of God. I have seen tough enough matches better than this. Dana Brooke is just embarrassingly bad. I don't really have any other way to say it. She is embarrassingly bad. I don't know how many times I have to say this. She has no business being on this show. This is supposed to be your flagship show. It's Monday Night Raw. You've got a lot of talented people down at NXT, down at the Performance Center, just, you know, itching and waiting for a spot, who frankly, in some cases, probably should already be on the main roster, and they're not. And to see her on television, you know, wrestling on Monday Night Raw is just embarrassing. And Alicia Fox was not much better in this match, but, you know, she was handicapped. I mean, what the hell is she supposed to do? At least I've seen Alicia Fox have some good matches before. Now, I will grant them the fact that they had all of, what, 90 seconds out there, I think this lasted, maybe not even. I don't know if their time got cut right before they went out or what happened. It's hard to have much of a match in 90 seconds. We went through this whole thing. That's how the whole Divas Revolution stuff started, and I was doing the Divas Stopwatch for so many years, because it became a joke. It became a parody of itself. You would literally have women come out. It could be a 6-woman tag. So you have a lot of different people out there. And the women have told the story since then, where they're in the gorilla position, literally being told before they even go out, go home. You know, like, you're going to go out there, and then 30 seconds later, it's going to be over. And so it's hard. You know, I have sympathy for them. It's hard to have a good match. I don't know if that's what happened here. I'm trying to make excuses in my head for you know, why this would have been so bad. And it was. It was really bad. Now, Emma came out. She hugged Dana when the match was over, like they were the best of friends. Dana did not know what to make about any of this. As good as Emma is, I'm not sure even she can get a good match out of Dana Brooke. I guess we're going to find out, because I suspect that match is coming. In fact, you know, they could add that to the pay-per-view tonight. I wouldn't be surprised if they threw that on there at the last minute. I mean, I'm trying to think back in my head, the best Dana Brooke match I've ever seen had to just be that first match with Asuka, when Asuka made her debut in NXT. I believe that was her debut. I remember that match being good. I remember that flying armbar that Asuka busted out of nowhere, and I just remember watching that going, whoa! And I thought, man, that was the best Dana Brooke match I've ever seen. So, but that's it. That's the only one I could think of. I don't see the point of having her on the show. I don't think she really is adding anything at the moment. But, you know, look, they obviously have their ideas. She should be down in NXT. She has no business being on Monday Night Raw. Somewhere in here, the announcers were doing an on-camera shot. I think they may have been running down the matches for Payback, or maybe they were giving a medical update on Kalisto. He had some kind of cervical spine injury. He'll be back in 2 weeks. But Michael Cole, all of a sudden, they're showing the announcers on screen, and Michael Cole is sitting there, Corey Graves is talking, and Cole puts his head down, like he looks down, and he keeps his head down for like 15 seconds. It looked like he fell asleep. Who can blame him sitting through this show? Then we had Seth Rollins, who, as Steve Austin put it on his podcast, is somewhat over. That's what Austin said. Seth Rollins is somewhat over. That was quite the statement. He's somewhat over. So, Anderson, Gallows, and Samoa Joe, okay, they take out Enzo Amore, which, what else is new? Enzo gets taken out every single week. So, it was Rollins, Big Cass, and Finn Balor against Joe and the Club. Rollins debuted a new finisher to replace the Pedigree at the end of the match here. He went to go Pedigree Anderson. He thought better of it. Instead, he set up Anderson in the Rainmaker position and delivered a high knee to the face for the win. Kenny Omega then sort of passive-aggressively tweets about Rollins stealing the move. Then people get all bent out of shape, and he tweets again. He says, "I'm not upset. I'm just ribbing the guys. Come on, guys. Don't start things. You fans love to start things." And he starts complaining about how the internet turns these things into something that it isn't. Of course, it's always the internet's fault, right? Oh, it's always our fault. Passive-aggressively tweet about a move you claim the guy stole, but then he gets upset when people start talking about it. Then don't tweet about it. You know how well sarcasm goes over on the internet. It goes over like a lead balloon. How does he not know this? How did he not see that coming? That was dumb. Come on, Kenny, what the hell? So the whole point of this is Omega uses the same move. He calls it the V-trigger. This is not the first time that Seth Rollins has used it. He's used it on TV at least once before. He used it in a match against Sami Zayn many months ago, although he didn't use it as a finish. Clearly, Rollins is a fan of his work. I remember WWE had polled members of the roster before this year's Royal Rumble. They asked them, who would you like to see as a surprise entrant in the Royal Rumble match? Seth Rollins said, Kenny Omega. And then WWE very quickly edited out all mentions of him saying that. They didn't waste any time in doing that. The point is, everyone steals everyone's shit in wrestling. This is nothing new. Now, is it right? Is it wrong? I'll defer to the talent on that. I'm sure they have their own protocol for that kind of stuff. I don't think it's my place to really say. But I am reminded of the scene in Beyond the Mat where the promoter, he brings Mike Modest and another one of his guys to a Raw taping for a tryout. And his guys are in the ring having a match. It's a dark match. Vince and Jim Ross and Jim Cornette, they're all kind of huddled around a monitor backstage. They're watching this match. And one of the guys tries this like cool-looking move. It wasn't even the finish, I don't think. And in the background, one of the WWE guys, I actually think it might have been one of the headbangers now that I think about it, he just goes, "I'm stealing it. I'm stealing that move." And maybe he was joking. Maybe he wasn't. Point is, this stuff happens all the time. Happens all the time in wrestling. There really is no such thing anymore as a new move. Unless you're like Ricochet or Will Ospreay. And in their case, they're not even human, I'm convinced. They do things that are just physiologically impossible for anyone else to do. But there really is no such thing anymore as a new move or a new storyline idea, a new storyline twist, right? And think about it. Like, a lot of it, if not all of it, it's all the same shit that's just recycled from over the years. If somebody turns on this guy, if like, we've seen it all before. The faces change, the names change, but the actual stories and the actual actions and events, this has been going on for 30, 40 years. There really is nothing new anymore. Everything in wrestling is recycled from the past. Every move you see, you can bet somebody else already came up with before, whether it's Mexico or Japan or wherever. I mean, you may think it's never been done before, but I'll bet you it has. It's more a matter of who popularized it, who made it famous. I think of Kenny Omega, me personally, I think of Kenny Omega, I think of the One-Winged Angel, which ironically Big Damo started using when he debuted down in NXT, Killian Dane. I don't know if he still is using that. I saw him use it once. I have not seen him use it lately, but that's actually kind of funny now that I think about it. So, you know, if they debut a new, you know, janitor gimmick for somebody and call him the cleaner, then I think Kenny Omega has a right to be upset. I like the way Alexa Bliss shut down the What Chance, or tried to anyway, in her promo. I really can't believe we're still dealing with that garbage 16 years later. She really was one of the highlights of the show. Her joy at the realization that Payback is in Bayley's hometown, and that means she gets to beat up Bayley in front of her dad. I thought that was great. So Bayley comes out, then so too does Sasha, because where one goes, the other, you know, is not far behind. We got our first real interaction here on this show between Sasha and Alexa, and you know, they gave away the first match on Raw a few minutes later. It was a 2-minute match. Despite that, okay, even though they gave it away, 2-minute match, Alexa Bayle got counted out. I do think that this could be probably the best women's feud they could put together on this show outside of Sasha and Bayley, assuming Sasha, you know, turns on Bayley at some point. I think Alexa and Sasha is a match that I'd really like to see. I can't say more than the Bayley match, because I still think that's the key match to do this summer. But after what I saw here, I'm looking forward to seeing what Sasha and Alexa can do, especially on the mic. Main event was a handicap match with the heel, The Miz, being outnumbered by the babyfaces, Jericho and Ambrose. This was completely ass-backwards. And pretty dull, honestly, for a main event heading into a pay-per-view. They brawled up by where the announcers were sitting. When the lights went out all of a sudden, they came back on. There's Bray Wyatt. He gives Ambrose a Sister Abigail into one of the LED boards. Bray and Miz, they take Jericho down to the ring. Jericho gives Miz a codebreaker. Wyatt gives him a Sister Abigail. Turns on Miz. Miz is patting him on the shoulder. Hey, like, they're best of friends. And so, yeah, Wyatt turns on him, gives him a Sister Abigail for good measure. Bad show. This was just a bad show overall. You have little glimmers here and there. But for a 3-hour show, you're heading into a pay-per-view 6 days later. No bueno. This was not good. So, speaking of said pay-per-view, Payback is tonight. They're in San Jose. We have the kickoff match is set to be Enzo and Big Cass against Anderson and Gallows. And they're also advertising a Miz TV segment with Finn Balor, which is fine. They're obviously in a holding pattern with Balor until Bray Wyatt finishes his horrific storyline with Randy Orton. And also, part of me wonders, you know, he had the concussion a few weeks ago. Obviously, if they didn't think he was over it, they wouldn't have cleared him, because they take that stuff seriously and they still have that lawsuit looming. So I don't think they would play games. But I do wonder if part of this is not just the fact that they don't have anything and they're waiting for Wyatt, but they just want to give him some more time and not really push him too much. I mean, even on Raw Monday night, he was in a 6-man tag. He wasn't in a singles match. If you think about it, aside from that one quick squash, I think it was against Curt Hawkins, I mean, Balor hasn't really done much physically on TV. So I think part of it is probably their way of protecting their investment, making sure that he is in fact fully over you know, the concussion and any symptoms and all that. And it's smart for them to do. They have to protect their investment. As far as Enzo and Big Cass against Gallows and Anderson, who wins? I'm going with Enzo and Big Cass for my prediction. On the pay-per-view itself, we have Neville defending the Cruiserweight title against Austin Aries. I think they do a title change here. Part of me hates to do it, because I don't think Neville's been beaten in months. I think he's pretty much been undefeated ever since he came back as a heel. I can't remember a single match that he lost, not clean anyway, since he came back as heel Neville. So he's got a nice run going. I figured he was going to retain at WrestleMania, and he did, but I also figured they were saving the title change for some point down the road. I don't know how many more matches you want to go before you pull the trigger on this. They could always, you know, flip-flop the belt back and forth. So I think they'll do a title change here. I think Aries wins the championship. We have Kevin Owens defending the U.S. title against Chris Jericho. And if Jericho wins, he goes to SmackDown with the U.S. title. I believe Owens then goes back to Raw, but I don't know that they've made that entirely clear. I'm going with Chris Jericho to win the match, but I'm going with Kevin Owens to retain the championship. So I think Jericho ends up winning by DQ. And I'm gonna just spit an idea out here, and you guys can let me know what you think. I think that Jericho wins by DQ when the Drifter costs him the title. I was going to say maybe he breaks the guitar over Jericho's head. I don't know that they would do that anymore with all the concussion stuff. Those guitar shots to the head may be a thing of the past, but I figure if this is it for Jericho, it'd be a good way to put heat on the Drifter, who has yet to wrestle a match on Raw. He's literally been drifting around every week. He drifted behind Jericho on TV last week. It'd be a good way to set up an opponent for Jericho when he comes back in a few months. Or they don't have to, but if they want to at least set something up in the event that they want to go down that road, this is one way to do it. And maybe what they do is they do the match on Raw the next night. I don't know if Jericho's final match is tonight or if his final date is tomorrow. It could be Raw, and if that's the case, you can have the Drifter screw him tonight. You could do the match on TV tomorrow, give the Drifter a big win, and off to the races. Hopefully they'll have better luck with him than they did putting Fandango over Jericho at WrestleMania all those years ago. But that's what I think is going to happen. We have Samoa Joe against Seth Rollins. This is a hard one to call here. It could go either way. They've done a pretty good job of protecting Joe so far. He really has not outright been beaten yet. It's only been a couple of months. I'm going to go with Joe. This is the match I think I could very easily be wrong on, but I'm going to go with Joe for my pick. Although this is hardly the end of the feud, I'm sure there's at least another match coming. We have the Hardy Boys defending the Raw Tag Team titles against Sheamus and Cesaro. I predict we'll go heel when the match is over, but the Hardys will retain. And then we have Randy Orton and Bray Wyatt in a House of Horrors match, even though it was originally advertised as a WWE Championship match. It will apparently now be non-title, because they have made no mention recently of the title being on the line, which is usually a telltale sign that it is not a title match. It's kind of like that Starrcade match all those years ago with Hogan and Piper. Hogan was the WCW champion, leader of the NWO, and they promote this match as this big deal. It's Hogan against Piper, and who can take down the NWO? And Piper beats Hogan with a sleeper in the middle of the ring. Place goes nuts. But they never did say that it was a championship match, and why? Because the title was never on the line, or else Hogan wouldn't have been going out by submission to Roddy Piper. So I'm sure there were a lot of fans who probably felt screwed over on that, but hey, WCW never advertised it as a title match. You just sort of assume, hey, if it's on pay-per-view, if it's the main event, surely it has to be for the championship. That's not always the case. But if it is non-title, there really is no reason for Bray not to win. The title is safe. Bray is staying on Raw, Randy is not, and Wyatt is probably feuding with Finn Balor next. You gotta give him some heat going into that feud. No reason at all for Wyatt to lose this match. I'm picking him as my winner. As far as the House of Horror stipulation, I mean, here's what we know. It's pinfall or submission only. It's gonna start inside the House of Horrors, whatever the hell that is, but the match has to end inside the ring. So, sounds very similar to the Boiler Room Brawl that Mankind had with Undertaker at SummerSlam back in 96. They taped the Boiler Room portion of that, I think, the day before the pay-per-view. They could do the same thing here. It may have already been taped, for all we know. Most of the match may already be over. I'm a sucker for matches like this, I'll admit. I really liked that Boiler Room Brawl in 96. I loved Final Deletion with the Hardys from the Hardy Compound. It's different. I like that kind of stuff, but there's no in-between here. This is either going to end up being just over-the-top fun or the next entry into the annals of wrestle crap. It's going to be one or the other. It all boils down to how creative they want to get with this. It would be a good time, I think, to debut somebody new to be aligned with Wyatt on Raw, maybe the formation of a new Wyatt family. I have said this before. I will say it again. I will pitch it as an idea for the match tonight. I would like to see Bo Dallas get that spot. We have not seen Bo Dallas on TV ever since the shakeup, even before the shakeup. It's been weeks and weeks and weeks since we've seen Bo Dallas on at least the main shows. Maybe he's been floating around on Superstars or something, but he has been away long enough. Last we saw of him, he was even growing a beard. I'm sure, I know Bray has said in interviews before that he would love to have the chance to work with his brother, so I'm sure both of them would love to work together. Now that they're on the same brand, Bo's not doing anything. Bray needs a new family because Rowan's on SmackDown. There's no reason not to do it. They're trying with Jinder Mahal. They're trying with the Colognes. Now we have Breezango getting a tag team title match on SmackDown. You know what? Bo Dallas, there's no reason to not give Bo Dallas an opportunity. Zero reason to not give him a shot. You can have him help Brother Bray. He can help him win the match. You have Brother Bray now and Brother Bo. And then over time, they could build the new family out from there. They could add another one or two members over time. But as far as my prediction on who wins, I'm going with Bray. We have Bayley in her hometown defending her Raw Women's title against Alexa Bliss. I do think Bayley is going to retain. It will be a rare instance of somebody going over in their hometown. And in what I assume is going to be the main event, we have Roman Reigns making his grand return, taking on Braun Strowman. If there's one thing I'm very surprised about is that there's no stipulation. I thought for sure they already had the straight match at Fastlane. I thought by now, after what happened a few weeks ago, it would end up being a stretcher match or an ambulance match. We've seen a few of those before. Nothing. Just a straight wrestling match. And because of that, and because countouts and disqualifications, I assume, are going to be legal, my fear is that they have Roman just sort of snap on Braun during the match, and he gets himself DQ'd. So Strowman wins, but again, it's like a cheap win. He only won because Roman couldn't control himself. Part of me wonders if that's why they didn't add any stipulations, and maybe they're going to give us some sort of cheap DQ finish. I don't know. I hope not. I hope they have a better plan than that. But I am going with Braun Strowman. I think Braun is probably in line for the next title shot against Brock. So when Brock defends it, great balls of fire. God damn, that sounds terrible. When they have that pay-per-view, it's probably going to be Brock and Braun in July. And you've got to build the guy up. There's no reason for him to lose again to Roman Reigns. They've done a very good job of building up Braun Strowman as this unstoppable monster. I know it kind of fits the story, it fits the narrative if the heroic babyface comes back after being nearly killed and gets the big win. There'll be plenty of big wins in the future for Roman Reigns. Braun needs this more than he does, and I think he will get it. I think he will get the win, and in a couple of months it'll be Brock Lesnar and Braun Strowman for the Universal title. I'll have a Payback review up later tonight or very early tomorrow morning on the YouTube channel, a Sound Off Extra. So if you are not subscribed to the YouTube channel, go on over there, Solomonster Sounds Off, hit the subscribe button. That should be going up later tonight. SmackDown Live from Des Moines, Iowa this past Tuesday. SmackDown poll, almost 2,000 votes. 65% thumbs up, 35% thumbs down. That may beat the 27% that Raw got this week, but as SmackDown shows go, this was one of the weak ones. I do not agree with that 65% mark. We'll have to agree to disagree on that. And part of it stems from the opening segment. We had Dolph Ziggler and Shinsuke Nakamura. Now, I am excited to see Shinsuke finally on the main roster where he belongs. I think Dolph Ziggler is a great first opponent for him. I'm sure Dolph will bump his ass off and make him look good, and they'll have a great match. That being said, we have a ways to go until the Backlash pay-per-view, and so they've got to try to keep this feud interesting, and they have to try to heat it up in some way. So this was Nakamura supposed to be doing an in-ring interview with Renee Young. She introduces him as the artist, Shinsuke Nakamura. That's their new name for him. Wasn't that the name they gave Aiden English on NXT? Right, he was the art, or he was the artiste. Maybe that'll be Nakamura's next program. They can feud over the name. I thought this segment was really bad. Okay, and I'm being nice when I say that. I thought this was really bad, mainly because of Ziggler's dialogue. All this stuff about Nakamura being an American. His name is Michael Jackson. Oh my God, this was cringeworthy. Who wrote this? I'm sitting there thinking to myself, who wrote this and thought this was a good idea? I mean, SmackDown usually hits the mark, but boy, did they whiff on this one. So then Nakamura gets the mic. He turns it around on Ziggler. He interviews Dolph. And after he said a few things, now he starts talking in Japanese. The crowd is giving him the what treatment. Nakamura needed Alexa Bliss to come out and shut these people up the way she did on Raw the night before. He called Ziggler a jackass, which people cheered because that was the only word they actually understood. Ziggler kicked him. Nakamura gave him an overhead exploder. That was cool. He went for the Kinshasa, Ziggler escaped. If they're really holding off until their first match for Backlash, which isn't until like the 20th or the 21st of May, I think actually TakeOver is on the 20th in Chicago, and then Backlash is on the 21st. That's 3 weeks. If they really are just going to have to kill time between now and then, it's going to be a long 3 weeks, if this segment is any indication. I also don't know why Nakamura had his mouth guard in for this. Renee Young, again, she brings him out to interview him. And all I could think is, I don't know, I mean, maybe he wanted to be prepared in case Renee decided to suddenly throw down with him. I would think wearing that thing wouldn't really do anybody any favors if you're trying to cut a promo, but that's just me. AJ Styles and Baron Corbin had a match. Kevin Owens was out there on commentary. He went to distract AJ when it looked like AJ might have victory in hand. AJ was prepping for the phenomenal forearm. And so Owens didn't so much interfere as he just kind of went over and started talking trash to AJ. And AJ kicked him in the face. Corbin ducked the forearm. Went for a power bomb, but AJ fell behind him, rolled him up for the pin. Owens and Corbin now, they start double-teaming AJ when all of a sudden Sami Zayn comes out. He makes the save. He hits Corbin with the Huluva kick, but he gets taken out by Owens. And then Owens leaves AJ laying with the pop-up power bomb. I still maintain that this probably is going to be the main event for Backlash, even though it is the U.S. title match, but it feels like the main event. They had a beat-the-clock challenge, with American Alpha beating the Clones in 5 minutes 17 seconds, which meant that if the winner of the Breezango Ascension match could not beat that time, then American Alpha would become the number one contenders for the tag team titles and would face the Usos. And then to continue the trend of the job guys getting pay-per-view title matches, Breezango went and beat the Ascension in 2 minutes and 41 seconds to win the beat-the-clock challenge and become number one contenders. And, you know, at least they're finally doing something with Tyler Breeze. You guys know I've been a big Tyler Breeze fan for a while now, so I am happy to see them doing something with him. You know, it beats the hell out of dressing in drag as Nikki Bella. But I can't escape the fact that this guy was on television a few weeks ago dressed in drag as Nikki Bella, and now he's challenging for a championship. It's just how they set these things up is bizarre to me, but It's a little less ridiculous than Jinder Mahal wrestling for the WWE Championship. See, that bothers me more. And again, I'm not fully against the idea. What I'm against is the idea that they treat this guy like crap for so long. He's treated as a joke, and now he's challenging for the world title. There's a big difference between Jinder Mahal challenging for the world title and Tyler Breeze getting a tag team title match. But in any event, I'm happy for him. Rusev is coming back. Speaking of happy, that makes me happy. He sent a taped promo in saying that I don't like Daniel Bryan. I don't like Shane McMahon. I will only appear on SmackDown if it's in a championship match at Money in the Bank, which isn't until June. Otherwise, he said, I may just go back to Bulgaria. And the people cheered. I'm noticing a trend here on SmackDown. A lot of the people from Southpaw Regional Wrestling are suddenly getting title opportunities. First, you have Chet Cheddarfield and Mr. McElroy getting tag team title match. And now we have Big Bartholomew who wants a championship. Although, did he specifically say WWE title? Because maybe they're setting this up as a U.S. title match if maybe AJ wins the belt. Maybe AJ Rusev for the U.S. title could be the next feud. I would think he's talking about the WWE title, and it's going to be Orton and Rusev at Money in the Bank, but I don't remember now if he specifically mentioned which title. But I am all for Rusev getting a big push, so if he really does end up in the title hunt, then they have my endorsement. Randy Orton and Eric Rowan in a no disqualification match. The announcers pointed out that Randy Orton just celebrated his 15-year anniversary since his debut on WWE television. And I was thinking back over his career, because I remember talking about it. I spent some time when John Cena hit his 10-year anniversary. I spent some time talking about it here on the podcast and talking about his best matches and all that kind of stuff. And so for Randy here, this is a big milestone, right? 15 years. And I was thinking about it, and look, Randy Orton is a big star, don't get me wrong, but I can't help but feel like as big of a star as Randy Orton is, I still feel like he should be a lot bigger than he is, right? He's a big star, but not as big as you would think. And I'm not really sure why I feel this way. When I think back over his career, I think back to I didn't want to just do a list of best Randy Orton matches. I mean, I could do that some other time, but I was thinking back over the highlights of his career. Like, when I think of Randy Orton, what are the things that come to mind for me? And, you know, obviously I think back to the Legend Killer stuff. I thought that was a money gimmick. The Backlash match in 2004 with Mick Foley, and the look on Orton's face when he took that back bump onto the thumbtacks. His never-ending feud with John Cena, how can I not think about that? Punting Vince McMahon in the skull, that was a good one, right? That was a good angle back in 09. I remember how ridiculously over he was those first few months after he split off from Legacy, and he kind of beat them in 2010 at WrestleMania. And they were a heel faction, and I always figured that they were setting up maybe for a big babyface turn for Cody Rhodes or for Ted DiBiase. It seemed like the only one who really was elevated coming out of that Legacy thing was Randy Orton, who was the last person who needed to be elevated. But boy, he came out of that thing. He was the most over babyface on that entire roster, far more than Cena, at least in terms of these crowd reactions when he was coming out. And it only lasted a few months, but man, he was ridiculously over. I remember his feud with Christian in 2011. That was, in my opinion, the feud of the year that year in WWE. All the matches the two of them had. I remember how pissed off people were when Christian won the title, and then at the tapings, you know, 2 days later, all of a sudden, he loses it. That really got people pissed off. I remember that vividly. I was probably one of them. But I remember that feud. I remember their match at SummerSlam. I think that was the best of the bunch. They had this great match. It was like a hardcore match or something they had. No DQ at SummerSlam. That was great. But I also, you know, I think back to 2011, and I think back to the matches that Orton had with Mark Henry. Now, Mark Henry had been around far longer than Randy Orton. I mean, Henry goes all the way back to 1996. And so he had been around for so long. He's just kind of there. You get used to him. He always got hurt. He never really got that big push, or if they started in that direction, he would always get injured. So now it's 2011, and they start this Hall of Pain thing, which started a few months earlier. He beat Big Show, but he was still just kind of there. So Orton wins the championship back from Christian. He goes on to whatever the pay-per-view was in September, and he has this pay-per-view match. And you think, oh my God, a title match on pay-per-view with Randy Orton and Mark Henry. That's terrible. That's awful. But the Hall of Pain stuff clicked. I mean, that was the best phase of Mark Henry's career. I think the Hall of Pain and then the fake retirement ceremony are for those two things alone, the guy belongs in the Hall of Fame. But I remember they had their match on pay-per-view, and Orton put him over clean with a World's Strongest Slam right in the middle of the ring. Just like that, Mark Henry beats Randy Orton, and he wins the World Heavyweight Championship for the very first time in his career. And Orton, he put him over clean again, I think at Hell in a Cell the month after that. So he, as much as anybody, I think, even though Henry was already kind of on his way with the Hall of Pain thing, Randy Orton, maybe more than any other singular person, I think, did a lot to really get Mark Henry over as a headliner, as a main eventer that year. And so that's one of the things that I remember about Orton when I think back to that kind of period. And then I think of the swerve at SummerSlam in 2013 when he cashed in Money in the Bank. I thought that was so well done. Now, I grew to hate the Authority stuff because it just went on and on and on for years. It seemed like there was no end in sight. But at the beginning, when they did the initial turn and the little twist there at SummerSlam, I just thought that was so well done. Those to me are the highlights when I think back to Randy Orton's career. You know, he won 13 world titles. He had a couple of suspensions in there, some injuries. Obviously, the guy's a future Hall of Famer. No question about that. And probably one of the best pure athletes that they've ever had. I mean, the guy has certain physical gifts. There's no doubt about it. I know people look at him sometimes and think, oh, Orton's boring. Randy Borton, he's lazy. Yeah, maybe he can be sometimes. But when people say, I sometimes hear wrestlers in interviews say, like, who's the best person you ever worked with? Or who do you think is the best on the roster in WWE? And wrestlers, guys in the business, guys in the company, a lot of them say Randy Orton. And you think, well, why? Because he's not the flashiest guy. So what is it about Randy Orton? The guy just has certain intangibles about him. Some guys have it, some guys don't. You know, again, Orton's what, third generation? He was born into wrestling. And he just has certain, you know, gifts that when he is motivated, he is one of the best in the business. I will give him that. There is no doubt about it. He is a special talent. And, you know, I don't know, but to go back to what I was saying before, it's weird for me to sit here having said all of that and say that he still feels like he should be a much bigger star than he is, and he's not. And I don't know if that ends up being his legacy or not, that he can never get to that level. Well, what level is that, right? I mean, he's a big star. How much higher do you want him to go? But I just feel that way. I don't know. I just feel that way. And he also has a lot of years left. So who's to say how the Randy Orton story is going to end? You know, we look ahead 5-10 years. You would think, unless he just wants to get out early, he's got a lot of years left in him. But 15 years in a mostly top position for much of that time, that's pretty impressive. And he did all of that with two strikes hanging over his head for much of that. And maybe I just answered my own question as far as why they never really seemed to run with him as their top guy. Maybe he was his own worst enemy. Orton and Rowan, to go back to that, they had a match. Match was okay. Rowan wedged a chair between the ropes. He went to go throw Orton into it. Orton reversed him into the chair and then finished him off with an RKO. Jinder Mahal came out. This was his big moment, right? I mean, he had a couple of interviews on Talking Smack. I know when he won the six-pack challenge a few weeks ago, he cut a very quick promo. But for all intents and purposes, this was the first real chance for him to come out on the main stage and cut a big-time promo. And I thought he did fine. you know, I didn't really think it was all that great. Orton was so focused after the match was over. He was talking about the House of Horrors match. Jinder comes out. He says, you know, you're overlooking me. All you're doing is overlooking me. Crouch-handed USA at him. He said, I'm being disrespected because I look different from everybody else. So he's stealing Mustafa Ali's gimmick from Raw. But, you know, he did fine. He went for a cheap shot on Orton. Orton knocked him down. The Bollywood Boys, who are now being called the Singh Brothers, they went after Orton. Jinder caught Orton with his Cobra Clutch Slam, whatever name he ends up giving it, I don't know. He left with the WWE title. They showed him and the Singh Brothers leaving in a stretch limo. Jinder is standing up through the sunroof, holding the belt high in the air as they drove off. That, I thought that was funny. I don't even know why I laughed. I even made that the new header in our Facebook group. And again, they have 3 more weeks. I'm still not convinced of this Jinder Mahal is WWE Championship material stuff, but they've got 3 more weeks to convince me. While we're on the subject of Jinder Mahal, this would be a good time to bring this up. On his podcast, Ryback, who has had quite a few things to say about different people, had something to say about the number one contender for the WWE title and his newfound physique. And this was transcribed by Wrestling Inc., so I'm going by what was written here. But this is what Ryback said, or part of what Ryback said. He said, speaking of tits, you know who I noticed had tits this week? Jinder Mahal. They did a close-up of his effing chest, and I just noticed it right away. I've never had that or anything because I don't, like, there's no reason to. Sure. When you get gyno, that's red flags right off the effing bat, Dr. Black. David Black works with WWE or did work with WWE. I don't know if he still does, but he was the man who helped oversee their wellness testing. And gyno, I'm sure most of you know what he's talking about. Gyno it's a slang term for like man tits, basically, which can be a side effect of steroid use. In a lot of people it is. It's the same condition that Rock had surgery to fix many years ago. That was during the phase where Rock was wrestling in a tracksuit back at the beginning of 99. I think that was post-surgery. So anyway, Ryback goes on. He goes, Jesus Christ, that shit doesn't happen on its own. And I like Jinder and he looks great, but I am pointing out the obvious. That doesn't just happen from effing drinking your protein shake. Quite the little burial there of Jinder Mahal. He may not think of it as a burial, but it's a burial if you go public saying something like that, right? It's one thing for the average fan to look at Jinder Mahal and say, oh man, this guy must be on something. Look at how he looked and look at how he looks now and it's not normal. Look, I can't sit here and say for sure if he is or isn't. Jinder says he's been training and he's been dieting. And that's how he looks the way he does. If that's the case, I would love to know what foods he's eating so I can avoid them and not get all of that acne that he's got on his chest and on his back. But coming from one of his peers, right? Coming from Ryback, a guy he's worked with before, that is quite the thing to go out publicly and say about somebody. And if Ryback looks at you and says, this dude's on steroids, you may want to ease up on that diet a bit. They are apparently going with Charlotte as a babyface now. She wrestled Naomi for the SmackDown Women's title to a no contest in the main event, which was a unique spot to see the women in here on SmackDown. We've seen Raw main events with the women, but not SmackDown. Well, actually, that's not true. I think that Alexa-Becky cage match where Mickie James returned, I think that was the main event on that show. But it has not been as common on the blue brand as it has been on the red brand. I suspect now with Charlotte being on SmackDown, that will likely change. It's weird, though, because they both got attacked at the end of the match here by this new trio of Natalya, Carmella, and Tamina. Of that group, none of those women strike me as a top heel in the women's division. I guess maybe Natalya is being positioned in that role as the leader of the group or the top women's heel. And Natalya is talented and all that jazz. Natalya is not the top heel of that women's division. I don't look at her and see her as the top heel of that division. That role was perfect for Charlotte. She excels in that role. And I think she could have then feuded with Becky Lynch and gotten a big SummerSlam match out of it or something. I mean, I guess she still can, even if they're both baby faces. I certainly wouldn't turn Becky, but you know, Charlotte, Becky, and Naomi as the top babyfaces is pretty strong, but the heel side now is lacking. And that would have been a good spot, I think, hindsight being what it is, to put Emma in that superstar shakeup. Instead of having Emma feud with Dana frickin' Brooke, she could have come over to SmackDown and she could have been, you know, a lead heel on this brand. Because, you know, evil Emma is the way to go. You could have turned Emma as well and given her a prime spot on Raw. Obviously, they're not doing that. And so, looking at what they're doing with Emma now with Dana, yeah, it would have been much better to just move her over to SmackDown and position her as the top heel on there. Becky Lynch never did show up here at the end. The heels beat down Naomi and Charlotte. They posed to end the show. A weak show overall, I thought, very weak. On Talking Smack, they had Baron Corbin attack Sami Zayn and lay him out. He also shoved one of the referees down. And then later on Twitter, Shane McMahon announced that Corbin has been suspended for 1 week, so he's going to miss TV this week and I guess be back on next week's show. The Backlash card, we still have 3 weeks, but this is how the Backlash card is shaping up so far. We have Randy Orton and Jinder Mahal for the WWE title. We have Kevin Owens and AJ Styles for the U.S. title. Likely Baron Corbin against Sami Zayn and Breezango against the Usos for the tag team titles. This reads like a bad SmackDown pay-per-view from that first brand split era. I mean, AJ Owens aside, even those bad SmackDown shows usually had at least one really good match. But that's kind of the way this thing's looking right now. Before we get to NXT, I told you I had news about Vince McMahon. And you know, people have asked me before, do I think Vince McMahon is ever going to write a book? And I've always said no, and even if he did, it wouldn't matter, because I'm sure half the shit in there would be made up anyway. But it looks like we're getting a movie about his life instead. Sony's TriStar Pictures will be producing the film, tentatively titled Pandemonium. Glenn Ficarra and John Requa, the director and executive producer of the NBC show This Is Us, are in talks to direct this thing. Vince himself, and this is the key here, Vince McMahon himself and WWE Studios are on board with this project. In fact, it may be a WWE Films release. So right off the bat, you know that it's going to be their sanitized version of events, and that's going to put a lot of people off. No word on a release date or casting or anything like that yet. This is going to be very interesting. I think this would work a lot better, and I said this on Twitter, as a miniseries on HBO or on Netflix. I just think there's far too much to cover in one movie. They're going to have to leave a ton of stuff out or just gloss over things, which if they have Vince's blessing, and again, they apparently do, I'm sure that there's plenty of stuff that's going to get left out anyway. But at least with a miniseries, you could devote more time to each period, to each phase of his life, his upbringing, which is really the part that I'm most intrigued by. I know there's people who are going to be like, I don't care about that stuff. I just want to hear about the steroid trial and the Monday Night Wars and Montreal and all this other stuff. To me, in my mind, yeah, that's interesting, but I've heard enough about that over the years. One thing I have not heard enough about is Vince's upbringing, and Vince is a weird dude. And so you know that stuff went down early in his life that shaped the kind of person he is today, and probably shaped a lot of the really sick shit that we see sometimes on TV, and we have seen with the Mr. McMahon character in the past. I made this comment many years ago on the podcast. I said, you know, I think the whole thing with Stan Kroenke all those years ago when they pulled out at the last minute, was it in Utah? I forgot what state it was in, but Raw was supposed to be in a certain building, maybe in Denver. And the NBA Finals necessitated that the NBA get a game, and so Raw got bumped. And Vince just had a complete meltdown. He went on ESPN, he buried the guy, then he buried all of us by going on TV the following Monday. We had to sit through this god-awful segment where Vince was literally insulting a Stan Kroenke lookalike in the ring. And I'm like, this is couch time with Vince McMahon. I mean, it took me that long to realize that a lot of the stuff we've seen in the promos and things that Vince has said on TV over the years, a lot of the weird stuff, it's like his therapy sessions that are just happening on live television and we have to sit through it. So I always think back, man, what happened in this guy's childhood to kind of make him the guy that he is today? Successful as he is, there's also a dark side to Vince McMahon. So I look at this and I say to myself, I'm most intrigued by the upbringing part of this whole thing. And the fact is, Vince had a messed up childhood, okay, to say the least. And I take you back to the interview that he did with Playboy. This was around the time that the XFL was just starting up. I still have a copy of it around here somewhere. That's how you know you're a wrestling fan, when you really do buy Playboy for the articles. Although, to be fair, I'm pretty sure wherever it is, my copy of the Sable issue is probably sitting right there with it. But they did this really in-depth interview with Vince. He opened up about his childhood in a way that I've not heard him before or since talk about. And he talked about living in a trailer park. He got court-martialed when he was in military school. He talked about his stepfather, who he absolutely hated. His stepfather was abusive. He was a terrible human being, if Vince is to be believed. He talked about how his stepfather used to beat him with his tools. I guess, you know, the guy was an electrician or a carpenter or something. And he used to beat Vince with his tools and with a wrench. And I'll never forget this quote in the interview. Vince said that, and maybe I'm paraphrasing here, but he said that he regretted that his stepfather, whose name was Leo, he regretted that his stepfather died before he had the chance to kill him. And he said, I would have enjoyed that. It actually bothered him that his stepfather passed away before he had the chance to murder him. So that says a lot right there about the home, I guess, that he came up in. And that's not even the weirdest thing from that interview. Okay, so right after that, they asked Vince, were you ever sexually abused as a kid? We know you were physically abused. Were you ever sexually abused? And he said he was. And he said, but it wasn't by a male. And then they press him on the fact, well, what do you mean? Like, are we then to believe, are we to draw our own conclusions from this? We know that you and your mother no longer speak. Is this why? Have we found the reason why that is? And I don't think Vince outright said yes, but he basically, in so many words, he basically said, yeah, that would be fair to say. So I just think you could probably do an entire movie on this guy's upbringing alone. Then you get into all the wrestling stuff with him buying the company from his dad and the territories and Hogan and WrestleMania and the steroid trial and competing with Ted Turner in WCW. And it's like, this needs to be a miniseries. You can't adequately fit all of this in a 2-hour movie, even a 3-hour movie. I don't think they would do a good enough job covering everything. But they're not doing it that way. And since they're not, and because the story is still going, I mean, Vince is not only alive still, but he's still very active. He's still very much involved, obviously, in the business. It's like, where do you end? Right? Where do you end this thing? It's hard to come up with an end point because the dude is still going. What I would do, since it is going to be a movie and not a miniseries, what I would do is I would cover his early years. I would cover him working for his father and first getting involved in the wrestling business. I would cover him buying the company from his father, raiding talent from the AWA and other promotions so you can cover the territory stuff, right up through the first WrestleMania. And the whole idea that if, you know, they banked everything on that first WrestleMania, they took out loans, and if that first WrestleMania doesn't succeed, he and Linda go bankrupt, there is no WWE. That was a very big gamble they took, and obviously it was successful and it paid off. And so it set him on the path to becoming really the most successful promoter in the history of the business. It's like after that first WrestleMania, it was off to the races. So I think that would be a good place to end it, with the success of that first WrestleMania. And if the movie does well enough, they could always do a sequel and cover all of that other stuff. Right? They have more than enough material to do another movie. So as far as the question, because I've been asked this also, the question of, well, who plays Vince? Who do you get to play Vince? Who could possibly do a good job of portraying Vince McMahon? If they mostly focus on his early days, let's say up until like the mid-80s, around then, I have to say, you know, I heard Wade Keller make this suggestion, and I agree with him 100%. I think John Hamm from Mad Men would make a great Vince McMahon. I think looks-wise, he could pull it off. And as an actor, obviously, he's very good, so I don't think that would be an issue. So I think John Hamm would be a good candidate for it. Now, if they cast older Vince, that is a little harder. I would almost prefer they find an unknown. I would almost just kind of prefer they find somebody who is not super famous. But if they could, if they had the chance to kind of pick out somebody who is an A-list actor, and he's a name that I haven't heard a lot about recently, but he's an incredible actor, and I think he could pull it off. And I also think he's got the hair for it and everything. I would say Dustin Hoffman. I haven't heard that name mentioned. I think Dustin Hoffman can pull off an older Vince McMahon. A little bit of makeup, he could probably nail it. Now, I want to credit Mike Johnson of PWInsider.com for this stuff that I'm about to get into. He has seen the early drafts of the screenplay for this movie, which have been floating around for the last 2 years or so. So the first draft would have been written around 2015. By no means does this mean that what I'm about to read to you is actually going to make it into the final screenplay. But this gives us a sense of the direction that this thing may be taking. And if you are worried that they may end up taking a lot of creative liberties with the stories they tell about Vince McMahon, then this probably does not put your mind to ease. Some of this stuff is amazing, though, and I wanted to read some of this to you. And by the way, my allergies are just kicking my ass here, so, you know, just bear with me here. This is straight from Johnson. I want to give him credit. This was a case where he has spoken with people in the Hollywood community who have seen these early drafts. So if you do not want any potential spoilers, because I can't say that some of this stuff won't make it into the final film, if you are that sensitive to spoilers, then skip ahead. But anyway, he says that the early working drafts of the script starts out in the 70s, Vince and Linda McMahon are already married, and Linda is working as a waitress in a nudie bar. I don't believe Linda McMahon ever did work in a nudie bar. And it's funny, because whenever I say that out loud, when I say nudie bar out loud, I can't not think of Al Bundy and how much I miss Married with Children. But there's a scene, I guess, in this draft, there's a scene at the nudie bar where Linda tells Vince that she's pregnant. And I guess that would have been with Shane. And Vince says, well, I don't want the mother of my child working in a place like this. And they go to leave. But she's still working. So the manager tries to stop her from leaving. And Vince, of course, beats the hell out of him right there in the nudie bar. And Johnson says the script makes it very clear that Linda is turned on by Vince beating up the manager. It's almost as if Vince wrote this thing himself. So then the script has Vince Sr., and this is another one of those things that as somebody who, you know, is a stickler for detail and stuff just annoys the crap out of me, but I guess Vince Sr. in the screenplay passes away during the steroid trial, which is absolutely not true at all. Vince Sr. died the same year that Hogan won the world title for the first time, which was like a full decade before the steroid trial. But in this thing, he dies during the steroid trial, and he makes up with Vince and all this stuff. During the trial, in the script, all of Vince's past affairs come out. And I guess there's a scene in a limo where his family is telling him, you're a terrible person. How could you do this? You're so horrible. But they tell him that, you know, you could be the next great heel in wrestling. Which means that all the events that led up to the Montreal Screwjob apparently never happened here in this film. And Mr. McMahon as a character is actually the result of his family telling him way back in 1994, for all of his infidelities, what a terrible person he is. So again, they're taking creative liberties with the telling of this story. A lot of big-time names are in the script. Jimmy Snuka, Roddy Piper, they are not accurately portrayed. I guess here the idea is that Vince McMahon found Roddy Piper in jail, and Jimmy Snuka was a porn actor before he got into the business, and Vince was kind of the mastermind behind turning them into pro wrestlers. And this may be the most comical part about this whole thing. There's a scene where Vince McMahon takes Linda to a French restaurant for their anniversary. I laughed my ass off when I read this. So he takes her to a French restaurant in Montreal for their anniversary. And he pitches a fit over the food. Something happened. The food's not good. Anyway, out comes the manager, who just so happens to be Andre Roussimoff. Andre the Giant. And it turns out the whole reason Vince even took Linda to this restaurant in the first place was because he had heard stories about this great giant. And he wanted to go see for himself. And that's how he discovers Andre the Giant and I guess brings him into wrestling. It is comically awful. Just comically awful. There's a scene in a later draft where Hulk Hogan is having sex problems because of all the steroid use, including his shrinking testicles. Hopefully I don't have to see that on film. There's another scene with a female wrestler. She comes on to Vince, who then confesses to Linda. The first thing Vince does is he goes to his wife, and he confesses in front of this other woman what just happened. And he confesses what this female wrestler said she wanted to do to him. And so, in response to this, Linda takes Vince into the empty stands in Madison Square Garden one night, and she does to Vince what this other woman said she wanted to do to Vince, whatever that is. I swear I couldn't make this stuff up if I tried. I'm actually trying to picture Linda McMahon, of all people, doing all of these things, and it's like, it's really messing with my head. So then there is a scene, and this, I guarantee you, will not make the final cut, but there is a scene in one of the drafts of the screenplay where Randy Savage is talking to Vince McMahon. You probably know where I'm going with this. And he's talking to Vince about how popular he is with little girls who just so happen to be around the same age as Vince's daughter. And Savage says to Vince, I don't know what prompts this comment, but he says to Vince, I would never think of touching Stephanie. There is no chance in hell that that makes the final film. But this really does appear in one of the early drafts. So yeah. If you are expecting an accurate or a mostly accurate portrayal of the life and times of Vincent Kennedy McMahon, and I would love to because I just think Vince genuinely has an interesting story without having to make shit up. Like, there are some people who actually are fairly boring, but maybe there was an event in their lives, there's a story or a movie that's made about them, and they take their creative liberties in making stuff up to kind of enhance the story. I really don't think you need to do that with Vince McMahon. Now, the issue, of course, is that Vince may not want a lot of those stories to be told, so you almost have no choice but to make stuff up, although there's no excuse to get details wrong, like Jimmy Snuka was a porn actor and Andre was managing a freaking French restaurant. But, you know, again, Vince has a genuinely interesting story to tell, and you don't have to do this. You don't have to make stuff up. But if this is any indication and that bothers you, then this may not be the movie for you. Now, on the subject of Vince McMahon, we got not one but two Vince stories this week. Chris Van Vliet did an interview recently with Adam Rose, and they talked about the fallout from that E60 special that ESPN ran on him many years ago, which I ranted about at the time. It was a great piece, and as good as it was, of course, WWE did nothing to follow up on it. So he opened up to Chris here in this interview about that and about the bunny. And this story here is just too rich not to share. So he said they did have meetings behind the scenes to talk about what to do with him after that E60 piece aired. Like, they were all sitting around going, all right, what do we do with this guy? Do we make him a family man now? What do we do? And he said eventually they decided to just ignore him and move on. How creative of them. They have a whole creative team. They can't figure out what to do with this guy. They were just handed this piece, this great mainstream media piece that portrays this guy in this positive light. And they're all meeting. God knows how many people are sitting in this room trying to figure out what to do. And so what do? We'll do nothing. Great. Great. So he said it was the same thing with the bunny. He says, we don't know what to do. So we'll just ignore it and we'll move on. Now, he said he thinks it was Road Dogg and some other WWE people who met with him. There was one night before Raw for a couple of hours. They were meeting backstage. They were talking about the bunny. Who's the bunny going to be? Who should the bunny be? They were trying to brainstorm. And he says he wanted the bunny to be revealed in the end as Justin Gabriel. Because he and Gabriel, I think they both grew up in South Africa together. They were friends going back to their teenage years. And he's like, just let him do it. Plus, he's a great athlete. So just let him do it. And WWE's response was, well, nobody really knows him anymore. And it's not going to get the reaction that we want. So then all of a sudden, someone, and he doesn't say who, suggests that Vince McMahon be the one revealed in the bunny costume. And Adam Rose just goes, I don't get it. Why? What's the payoff? I don't understand. To which I say, idiot! It's Vince McMahon, the owner of the company. You could have done a storyline with Vince McMahon. You don't argue, you don't debate the point. They weren't going to do anything with you anyway. Who cares why? That's one example where you don't need an explanation why. It may make no sense. It doesn't matter. You're going to work an angle with the owner of the company, dude. You're going to be, you know, you're going to be, at least for a certain period of time, guaranteed television time. It's going to be a memorable angle. You never know where it may lead. But even if it's just a one shot, dude, you get to work with Vince. He couldn't understand it. Why? Why would we do this? But the idea was that, you know, they just turned around and said, we don't know where to go, so why not just have a crazy billionaire be the one to be in the costume? Now, he doesn't say if the idea actually made it all the way to Vince, if Vince was in the room when this was all being discussed, but obviously it never happened. I think that would have been hilarious. I think Vince doing the crazy old man gimmick would have been great. And judging from some of the things I've seen on TV lately and this great balls of fire nonsense, it looks like he's finally living the gimmick.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
NXT this week opened with Nikki Cross coming out and calling out Ruby Riott. Ruby came out, two of them had a wild brawl, and that led to a match being signed later in the show. Drew McIntyre and Andrade Cien Almas. Good match here, stiff match. Very hard-hitting here between these two. Almas did his signature spot where he kind of lays in the ropes. And McIntyre booted him right in the face, knocked him out to the floor. I thought that was kind of cool. Almas got some offense in, but this really was not as competitive as you would think. McIntyre took most of it. He won with the running boot. If I had to venture a guess, I know it's early. McIntyre only first re-debuted a couple of weeks ago. But I would say that they are setting up for probably a McIntyre title match and probably a title win over Bobby Roode in Brooklyn in August. I would think that that's probably their likely destination. Nikki Cross attacked Ruby Riott while Ruby was making her way to the ring for their match, which never actually did get started. Another brawl broke out. Referees had to pull the two of them apart. Ruby did do a stage dive onto Nikki before finally being dragged to the back. They aired a tremendous video package on Roderick Strong, and I'm so glad that they did this, because let's be honest here, Roddy has just been flat ever since he came to NXT. He hasn't even really been focused on, we don't know much about the guy. And let's also be honest about something else here. Even the people who watched him for years in Ring of Honor and PWG, ask yourself this question. How much did you really know about Roderick Strong, the person, the man, right? Some people might have known his backstory. I'm willing to bet most people probably never did. Other than he's a great wrestler, which obviously he is, but what else do we know about this guy? Here, they took us to the place where he grew up. He told this very emotional story about how his father was an alcoholic, and one day his mother, who also had her own issues, went up to his dad at home. He was sitting, I guess, watching TV or something. And his mom just went right up to him and shot him in the chest. Now, he didn't die. He suffered a collapsed lung. But this all happened when Roddy was just a kid. These are some of his earliest childhood memories, and clearly it affected him. His father was also the one, though, who introduced him to pro wrestling. I think his father was doing some wrestling himself, you know, on an independent level. And he introduced his son to the business. And once he did, he knew that this is what he wanted to do with the rest of his life. And they promoted part two for the series. I guess they're going to do at least one more video this Wednesday. It would be nice if they maybe worked out a deal with Ring of Honor to use some footage from his matches that they can incorporate into this next video. It's very similar to what they did with the CM Punk DVD many years ago, where they got footage from ROH. Joe Koff, you know, of ROH, has been very vocal in saying that, you know, they have no problem working with WWE in terms of licensing footage to them to use for stuff like this. So I don't know if they did or didn't. I guess we'll find out in a few days. Hopefully they did. That'd be kind of cool. But this was great stuff, and it really helps us understand more about this guy who, again, when you stop and think about it, we didn't know much about him before. And maybe that's part of the reason why he's just kind of been there. But honestly, they should have done this months ago. I don't know what took them so long. I mean, he's already been in there for about 5 or 6 months. There really is no reason why it should have taken this long to kind of bring us into his background and let us know more about him and why we should care about him. Aleister Black beat Kona Reeves with the Black Mass Kick. He's got a sick entrance. He's got a sick finish. It almost doesn't even matter what happens in between. Like, he could be a marginal wrestler and still have a real good shot of getting over because of the entrance and because of the finish. But it just so happens that he is a really good wrestler on top of everything else. Plus, he also has some kick-ass entrance music. So there really is no reason to think that this guy won't be a huge star at some point. I guess the one thing we don't yet know is we haven't heard him speak. He's been silent. But again, if he's at least adequate on the microphone, I think he'll do just fine. William Regal told Asuka that next week they will have a battle royal to determine a new number one contender for her NXT Women's Championship. Now, to follow up on the possible Ember Moon injury that I mentioned last week from the most recent NXT tapings, I think that came as part of the battle royal that Regal was talking about here. Someone pointed out a photo to me from the Performance Center that somebody tweeted with all of the NXT people. In the photo, Ember has her arm in a sling. So she did suffer some sort of arm injury. How serious it is, we don't know because WWE hasn't said anything, but clearly she's hurt. Hopefully it's not too serious. Main event was Tyler Bate defending the WWE United Kingdom Championship for the very first time on NXT against Jack Gallagher. I think they said that this was the second defense. I think there might have been a defense at Fan Access this year at WrestleMania, but this is the first time we're seeing this championship defended on NXT. As I'm sure you might guess, I love this match. They had a lot of really cool sequences, a lot of really cool moves and reversals. And I mean, it was a lot of old school wrestling, but it worked. And I thought, you know, people were digging it. I was digging it. These guys are just very good at what they do. Gallagher, I mean, we've seen Gallagher do this on 205 Live and on Raw. Obviously in the Cruiserweight Classic. He's a very unique performer. He takes a style that not just anybody could do. It would be very easy to just be completely bored by it. And I'm sure some people are listening to this going, well, I am bored by it. I don't like any of these guys. And that's fine. But Gallagher is a special performer, and Tyler Bate is also very good. It's hard to look at Tyler Bate and realize he's only like 20, or was he 21 or something? It's crazy to think about. But they had a really fun match here. Very simple story, too, with Gallagher working over Tyler Bate's arm. In the end, Bate hits the Tyler Driver 97 for the win. They show Trent Seven, Mark Andrews, Pete Dunne, and Wolfgang at ringside watching. I saw Wolfgang. I got very excited. All of them were smiling and clapping except for Dunn. Pete Dunn was not happy. He had this sneer on his face, like he didn't want to be there. One thing Tom Phillips made very clear on commentary multiple times, in fact, is that there is a UK show coming exclusively to the network very soon. So I guess much like 205 Live was born out of the Cruiserweight Classic, it looks as though a similar show will end up coming out of the UK tournament. They did not give a date, but they said very soon. And I haven't really been keeping up with 205 Live because I just can't get excited enough to do so, but I am definitely going to give the new UK show a chance, absolutely. I'm curious if they end up taping it from Full Sail or if they tape it over in the UK. Frankly, I think they ought to be taping 205 Live from Full Sail, but they still insist on doing it after SmackDown in front of a dead crowd. And I think the show suffers a lot as a result, so I wish they would make that change. But there is a UK show coming very soon, and I am looking forward to that. Now, I mentioned at the beginning of the show that I was going to introduce a new segment here this week. I was, in fact, going to try to find a segment on Impact Wrestling this week that I liked and talk about it. It's a little something that we call Say Something Nice About Impact.
Say Something Nice About Impact.
Now, maybe I just picked a bad week because this was a lot harder than I thought it would be. This overall was just not a good show. The Josh Matthews stuff is absolutely horrendous, and he's in almost every single segment on the show, which makes it even worse. I really don't know how people can stand it. But I did say I would try to find something I like, and I did. First of all, I instantly recognized Fala Ba from Booker T's Reality of Wrestling promotion, so that was nice to see him making his way up in the world. I liked the match, though, between Moose and Davey Richards. I thought they had a good match. I don't really get the point of the whole grand championship thing and all the rules and the judges and everything. I think that's dumb, but the match was good. They had two NFL players in Moose's corner at ringside, D'Angelo Williams and some other guy, Gary Barnage, I think his name was. That's what I wrote down here. They beat up Davey when the match was over, then celebrated with Moose, made Moose out to be kind of a big deal, and Moose has gotten better since the last time I saw him. So, thumbs up. I thought this was good.
Say something nice about Impact.
See, it is possible to find something nice to say about Impact. By the way, I love how Matt Sydal made his debut on Impact on Thursday, and on Friday, WWE uploaded a video to their YouTube channel showing Randy Orton giving Evan Bourne a midair RKO. It's like, I saw that, I'm like, wow, what a coincidence. But there is other Impact news that isn't so rosy. There was an ugly incident backstage at the Impact tapings this week. In fact, it was last Sunday, involving Bob Ryder and Jeff and Karen Jarrett. PW Insider said that Karen confronted Ryder about a hotel room that he was supposed to have booked for her, but he did not. And she started screaming at him and she left. And then a few minutes later, Jeff confronted Bob Ryder and started yelling at him and told him to leave. Ryder packed his stuff. He left, even though the show was still going on. I believe his job or one of his jobs is to time out all of the matches on the show, which is, I guess, kind of the same position that Gerald Briscoe used to have in WWE. I think Billy Kidman does that now. So anyway, he leaves or goes to leave, and they got into another shouting match before he actually left, and finally he gets in his car and he drives off. Ryder has since been back in the office, working as if nothing ever happened. Ed Nordholm of Anthem, the Owl Master, told Pro Wrestling Sheet that it is an internal matter. It has been resolved to everyone's satisfaction. So the old nothing to see here, people. That whole thing. I bet Bob, here's what I think happened. Here's a scoop for you. I bet you that Bob booked them at a Best Western instead of the Marriott, and Karen wasn't having any of that shit. That's what I think happened here. There was a big return at the Impact tapings this past week. It has not yet aired, so because I know some of you are allergic to spoilers, I'm just going to wait until after it airs. I'm not even going to talk about it. It involves the whole Jeremy Borash, Josh Matthews storyline, which isn't exactly setting the wrestling world on fire right now anyway. Also, it looks like Gunner and Crazy Steve are on their way to NXT. Apparently, Crazy Steve has accepted an offer from WWE, and so the match that you saw Crazy Steve in, it was the Decay against LAX, I think, at the end of Impact on Thursday. That was Steve's swan song with Impact Wrestling. He's on his way out. He'll be doing some independent dates before he makes his next move. Gunner is supposedly about to take his medicals if he hasn't already done so. Yeah, I look at this, and they really are turning into NXTNA. I used to joke about it when they brought in Samoa Joe and Bobby Roode and Austin Aries and Eric Young. Now it's just getting out of hand. And finally, Twitter user at Striga translated an update from Katsuyori Shibata on his condition from Shibata's Real Talk blog, which apparently is behind a paywall. Shibata said the right side of his body is still handicapped. This is following the headbutt and that long match he had with Okada several weeks ago. And he also said that he is going to need another surgery in May. I presume that means brain surgery. I don't know what other kind of surgery it would be. He also says he does want to return to wrestling. I think wrestling should be the least of his concerns right now. It's time for the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email them to me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. I had one person tweet me a link to something that Vince Russo said on his podcast, and I also got an email from Rob asking me about it too. On his podcast, Vince Russo said he could take Jack Gallagher in a fight. What do you think? As I told Broken Falcons fan on Twitter, and I laugh, by the way, way too hard at that name, I'm not sure that Russo realizes that Gallagher used to do MMA and won both of his fights by submission. I would love to see him try. Oh, how I would love to see him try. That's a fight that I would pay for. Jad from Southeast London, England. We've had almost a month for it to sink in that The Undertaker has retired. Unfortunately, I think he retired several years too late, and the shape that he is in, particularly in the last couple of years, showed that. Some might say he should have retired after he went 20-0 in the end of an era Hell in a Cell match, while others might say it should have been against Brock, or after Brock broke the streak. In my opinion, last match where I thought he actually put on a really good showing was the Hell in a Cell match with Brock in October 2015. What, in your opinion, is the last great match The Undertaker had, and when do you think he should have retired? I think the last great match that Undertaker had was that SummerSlam match that he had with Brock Lesnar 2 years ago, the one where they did the dual sit-up and they laughed at each other. That was the last one. I think before that one, you'd have to go all the way back to the end of an era Hell in a Cell match with Triple H. I thought the Punk match at WrestleMania 29 was good. I thought that was actually the best match on the WrestleMania card that year. I wouldn't call it great, but that was a pretty good match. But the Hell in a Cell, I thought it told a great story. I love the near fall spot where Shawn gave him the super kick right into the pedigree. You know, the ref counted to 2.9 before Undertaker kicked out. And then after the match, you get that shot of all three of them standing on stage together for the final time. The fact that he went 20-0 that night, it would have been a fitting end, I think, to his career had it just been over at that point. The one criticism I could see people having, though, of that, if you do have that end of an era match as the end for The Undertaker, I think some people might say, well, Undertaker deserved his last moment to not be shared with someone else or to not be overshadowed by Shawn Michaels or Triple H. It should have just been him the way it was this year. I think that's a valid point, but hindsight being what it is, I still think WrestleMania 28 should have been it. WrestleMania 28 really should have been it for him. I know he came back. He had a really good match with Punk the year after. Like I said, that could have worked too. You could have made that work as the end for him because of the circumstances around that match, right? He wins the match. He beats CM Punk. He gets possession back of the urn. They built that whole thing around the death of Paul Bearer. And so that last shot of him in the ring posing, doing the classic Undertaker pose, posing with the urn in the ring, paying tribute to his old manager, I think that would have been a nice way to end it too. Honestly, I think WrestleMania 30 all the way to 33, in terms of those matches that he had, none of them were necessary. Not a single one of them. Santos from Lancaster, California. With AJ and Nakamura poised to be the top babyfaces on SmackDown, should they turn Randy Orton heel against either one of them? After his feud with Wyatt is over, maybe having Orton attack AJ and setting up something for SummerSlam. I don't know that Orton has to be a heel to feud with AJ Styles, but I have been bored to tears by his babyface run as champion so far. It could just be the Wyatt feud specifically that has soured me on him. And they're not turning Orton for a while, at least, because he's got Jinder, right? He's got Jinder Mahal. If they slot him with Rusev next or Baron Corbin, you know, you're not going to have Randy Orton going into either one of those things as the heel. So any Randy Orton heel turn, it's very premature. It's not happening anytime soon. But they could do it and still have enough guys on the babyface side. So it's like you said, Styles and Nakamura are clearly being positioned. Nakamura's not there yet, but clearly they want him to be. There's already talk about doing Styles and Nakamura next year at WrestleMania, possibly for the championship on the SmackDown side. So let's assume that those two guys are going to be two of the top guys on SmackDown, right? Two babyfaces. You've got Luke Harper. If they ever want to give him a renewed push, I think he could be a solid upper mid-card, maybe even low main event babyface. Sami Zayn, he could be whatever you want him to be. Sami Zayn can be in the mid-card. I think Sami Zayn could be a headliner as well for SmackDown. I know some people would disagree with that. They don't see him in that role. But I remember his work in NXT. I know, you know, what he's capable of. And if he gets, you know, he gets a groundswell of support from the fans. I'm not going to say it's going to be Daniel Bryan all over again. I don't know that they could ever really match that kind of magic, but he could be that kind of guy. He could be that underdog babyface for them wrestling in main events. So now you've got Styles, Nakamura, you've got Zayn, you've got Luke Harper. Then you look at the heel side. You've got, let's say if he turns, you've got Randy Orton. You've got Kevin Owens. You've got Baron Corbin. Maybe Rusev, assuming they don't, you know, turn him. So, yeah, it would work. If they wanted to turn him, it's not like they would be lacking. They could definitely do that if they wanted to. It's just not happening for a while. Impressive from Queens. What do you think would be the better build for SummerSlam this year? Sasha Banks and Bayley or Sasha Banks and Alexa Bliss? Sasha and Bayley, because it's back in Brooklyn 2 years after they had that great match at TakeOver. But I just was talking about that earlier in the Raw review, you know, after last Monday. I think Sasha and Alexa would be fantastic too. Just the probably the dialogue and the interaction back and forth would be kind of fun. Just not for SummerSlam though. For SummerSlam, I think it should be Sasha and Bayley. He also wants to know how long until we get Bray against Braun now that they are back on the same brand. I don't think it happens until at least later in the summer. If we assume that Bray is going to get Brock in, or rather Braun, I should say, is going to get Brock at that pay-per-view in July. I can't even say the name. And if we assume that Braun does not win the championship, then Braun is going to need an opponent for SummerSlam. I like the idea of Jeff Hardy maybe being that opponent. I like Balor as a possible opponent for Strowman. They could do Braun. And by the way, if you're one of these people who hears that and is like, Finn Balor is an opponent for Braun Strowman, are you out of your mind? Look, if you want to see Finn Balor go in there and get demolished by Braun Strowman, that's fine. But I still think what I'm saying is the two of them could have a good match. I don't give a shit what you think about the matchup between them, big guy, little guy. I could not possibly care less about that. That's not even what I'm talking about. I'm just looking at this as different potential opponents for Braun. There's only so many big guys, right? You're not going to find very many guys his size on the brand to match him up with. And we've already seen him in Big Show a couple of times. They've had a couple of good matches. I don't need to see it again. So who do you put him in the ring with? Most guys that Braun Strowman is going to be in the ring with are going to be smaller guys. You just got to deal with that. That's just the way it is. They don't make guys that look like Braun Strowman, okay? And if he was on SmackDown, yeah, you could do him and Corbin, okay? But he's not on SmackDown. He's on Raw. So Jeff Hardy would be a good opponent, I think. Finn Balor would be a good opponent for him. They could do Braun and Bray, I suppose, at SummerSlam, but I'm torn then on who should be the face and who should be the heel. I feel like Bray should be the face, and I don't see that happening for a while, so it'll probably be a while before we see the two of them really interacting and working a match or working a program together. Of course, now that I say that, watch on on Monday night, they'll set that up as the next feud now. That's what I said about Jinder a few weeks ago. I got to watch now with what I say here in the mailbag. Somebody wrote in to me 2 weeks ago asking about Jinder Mahal. Do you think Jinder will ever be like a main eventer? Could we ever see him as like an upper mid-carder or a main eventer? And I was like, no, because that's not the role they brought him in for. Now the guy's wrestling for the freaking championship on the next pay-per-view. But I don't see this happening for a while with Bray and Braun. I just don't. But there definitely is a ready-made program there when they do want to go there. Denise, all the way from Turkey. There is a minor NXT spoiler in his question, so just a warning. Candice LeRae is my favorite female wrestler. She recently debuted at the NXT tapings. Do you think Candice would be the right person to finally beat Asuka? I don't. I think it's either Ember Moon or, like I said, I would have Hojo, Kairi Hojo, win the women's tournament if she's... Because supposedly she's signed to WWE. I don't know if she'll be in the women's tournament or not. I'm assuming she will be. Maybe she won't. But if she is, I would have her win it, and I would let her be the one to beat Asuka. One person in our Facebook group floated the idea of having them call Asuka up to the main roster in a few months without even being beaten. She can remain undefeated. They could vacate the championship. Have the winner of the women's tournament become the new NXT women's champion. That would be okay too. I'm not fully opposed to the idea of Asuka just coming up to the main roster unbeaten. I wouldn't do it that way. I would have her beaten by, you know, one of the people I just mentioned. But I wouldn't hate the idea. But if you have somebody beat Asuka, it immediately makes them a big deal in that division. And that's, you know, why I think I would probably go ahead and do that. Michael from Arkansas, when The Undertaker returned in 2000 as the American Badass, there were mixed feelings about it. Some people liked it, some people hated it. But I thought it was different, and I could not picture the Lord of Darkness in that early 2000 era. What were your thoughts on it, and do you think he should have returned as the Dead Man? I was not a fan of it at the time. I loved the whole Dead Man gimmick, and you know, when I saw him in the trench coat and all that, I at first was not a fan. I have warmed up to it though since then. I just tweeted something out a few weeks ago. I was watching I was watching parts of the Rock Triple H Iron Man match from Judgment Day in 2000, which I maintain is the best Iron Man match they've ever done. And that was also the night that Undertaker debuted as the Biker for the first time. He came out. I could watch that finish 1,000 times and never get tired of it. I just thought it was so great. And the people lost their minds. You got to go back and watch the end of that match. It was like a cheap no DQ. It was like a cheap, not no DQ. It was a cheap DQ finish in the final fall. So I could see some people being like, oh, come on. I've been watching this for 60 minutes. This is how the match ends. But I loved it. And it's very rare that you see anybody get that kind of reaction when they either debut or they return. This, though, was one of the better ones. But yeah, over the years, I've warmed up to the character. And one of the things that I kind of regret is the fact that here in his later years, it looks like he's done now, Undertaker. I wish heading into this final feud, this final match with Roman Reigns, they would have given him the chance to actually go out there. You know, if he wants to be dressed up as the Dead Man and do all the poses and stuff, that's fine. But this really was the time. And this goes back to the rant I went on about being upset with how lazily that whole thing was booked. I mean, I'm sure they had a story in mind, and whatever the hell that story was, I didn't buy it, I didn't like it. I thought if this is going to be it for The Undertaker, and I thought going in that this is probably going to be it, you had to really build this up a lot better than they did. It was like every other Undertaker WrestleMania match where he just sort of shows up, you get him for a couple of segments, he doesn't really say a lot, he doesn't really do a lot. If you know going in this is probably it for him, how do you not blow that up into such a like a much bigger deal than it was? I will never understand that. But anyway, my long-winded point here is one of my regrets about the way they handled that was I really wanted at least once to have The Undertaker grab the mic and actually talk to us. Don't just grunt. Don't just roll your eyes in the back of your head. Don't just look up at the stupid WrestleMania sign and it's like, oh, it's implied. Okay, I guess we have a match here. Grab the mic and actually talk to us. Talk about the fact that, you know, you feel like this is going to be your last ride, and you just tell us exactly why it is that we should care about this Undertaker Roman Reigns match. Why is it so important? Why should we look at this match as being anything different than any other Undertaker match? And it would have been nice to hear from him talking about his career, talking about all the other souls and all the people he's beaten. But doing it in a more human kind of realistic way. You know what I mean? It's almost like a hybrid mix, I guess, of that version of The Undertaker who would go out there and would cut these great promos. And the Dead Man version that we got. We didn't get any of that. We didn't really hear from him. It was very paint-by-numbers BS, and I think that was a big mistake. One of the more underrated aspects, I think, of that version of Undertaker was his promo ability. He could go out there, he sounded like a total badass, right? I mean, go back and watch the sit-down leading up to the first Brock Undertaker match at Unforgiven in 2002. They did this great segment, which was kind of weird. It looked like an interrogation with him sitting at a table with Brock, and Stephanie McMahon was the GM and she was moderating. Undertaker cut this fantastic promo on Brock. It was so great. And I watched it just a few days ago, and I just remember thinking, man, I wish we could have had one more chance to see and hear that version of The Undertaker before it was all said and done. And unfortunately, we didn't get that. But I've definitely warmed up to that character over the years. And I'll go one step further also and say Big Evil. You know, in 2003? No, 2002. You know, he kind of morphed a little bit more. It wasn't so much the American Badass. He turned heel. He cut his hair. And he became Big Evil. And Big Evil also, I think, is an underrated incarnation of that Undertaker character. As a heel, I thought he was pretty, he was pretty damn good. And I still laugh when I think back to him beating up David Flair, you know, in the shower stall. This was to build up to the Ric Flair match at WrestleMania. He went and beat up his son. Undertaker just showed up, I think, at the, back then it wasn't the, you know, Performance Center, but wherever it was, they had the practice rings, and he just beats the hell out of David Flair. He sits down next to him, because David's like half beaten to death here. And Undertaker's just sitting next to him, and David's like, oh, stop. Like, what are you doing? And he's just like, what am I doing? I'm kicking your ass. That's what I'm doing. Like, that version of Undertaker just was such a badass. So anyway, to answer your question, yes, I was not a fan at first. I did warm to it over the years. And I think that they made a really big mistake by not letting us in on that a little bit more here before he finally called it quits. Lance from Louisville, my question is about The Rock. In 1998, he was one of the hottest heels. Then the crowd began to cheer him towards the later part of the year. WWE never actually turned him from heel to face, but we know that at the Survivor Series, he reverted back to being a heel when he aligned with Vince McMahon to win the title. Do you remember a specific event or time when the fans started to root for The Rock between his heel phases in 1998? If not, was this one of the more natural face turns of all time? Completely natural. Completely natural. It started after the SummerSlam match with Triple H. I actually remember him being on the Home Shopping Network that night. That was back when they had the wrestlers on there hawking all their stuff. You could already see it. Like, that night that he lost the championship to Triple H. And he was a full-on heel in that match. But you could already see, you know, the direction that it was going in. And I don't think it was any one thing. When you have somebody with that much charisma, people are going to naturally gravitate to them. And after a while, no matter how dastardly a heel they may be, people are going to start to cheer for them. And that's exactly what happened with The Rock. Vibhav from Indore, India. Before Hall and Nash jumped ship to WCW, they were booked very strongly in their last pay-per-view appearance at In Your House, Good Friends, Better Enemies. Nash looked like a badass in the main event against Shawn Michaels, and Razor had a good long match with Vader. WWE could have booked them to be completely dominated, but they did not. What was the reason for them being booked so strongly on the way out? Because to do it any other way would have been bad business. I mean, look, they wanted to give Shawn Michaels an edge, right? He was the pretty boy. He was the dancing boy. He was the heartbreak kid. And they wanted to show that he could hang with the bigger guys. And he had a tough side to him. He was like, he had a hardcore side to him. That's why they made the match no holds barred, right? If they make Diesel look like a clown and Shawn beats him in 5 minutes, first of all, you're screwing the people who paid $30 to see a main event on pay-per-view, and it doesn't benefit Shawn Michaels at all. It's much better for him if he takes a beating from this giant man, right? Former world champion. If he hangs with him and then he beats him in the end. And that's what happened. He took everything Diesel threw at him. Including a leg from Mad Dog Vachon that he pulled off of him. And he took all of it. He took all of it and he threw it right back in his face and he beat him. And that, also, they had a cage match. And you got to remember, back then, like, those Madison Square Garden house shows were a bigger deal than they are now. So they had a cage match that they were promoting for MSG the following month, only a few weeks later, and with Shawn and Diesel. And so I don't think it would have been very smart for them to do this pay-per-view match, make Diesel look weak, and then turn around a few weeks later and expect to sell out the Garden to see these two in a cage, right? So that may have played a role in it also. And the same thing with Razor. You know, Vader was the new guy. Vader was the guy they were grooming for the championship, even though plans changed. It's way more impressive to go in there and hang with the guy, take his best shot, and then beat him. Jason in Atlanta, buy or sell on the better brother versus brother feud, Bret and Owen Hart from November 93 to October of 94, or Undertaker and Kane from October 97 to September of 98. Buy on Bret and Owen. I'm going to buy on Bret and Owen. Bret and Owen was just great classic storytelling with two actual brothers. Real brothers. They went out, they had those two classic matches to back everything else up. It's almost like the matches were not an afterthought, but like the matches weren't even the point, right? It was the story that they told. It started at the Survivor Series when Owen got eliminated. And I mean, that's the way they told that story, I think, was just fantastic. And what it also did was it made Owen a star in that company. Because before that, he was just an undercard guy. And after that, he became a top player there. And to think, you know, Owen wasn't even their first choice for that angle. I know I've talked about this before, but they wanted Bruce. They wanted Bruce to be the brother to feud with Bret. Bret said no. Bret talked about this once. He was on Chris Jericho's podcast. He said Owen was ready to quit. He was going to go off. He was going to become a fireman or something. I think one of the other brothers, Keith, was a fireman. I remember that because Bobby Heenan mocked him endlessly for it on commentary. During that Survivor Series match, where it was the Hart brothers against Shawn Michaels and the Knights. But they wanted Bruce, and Bruce was going to challenge Bret to a match, and Bret was going to say no. Owen would stand up for Bret and get destroyed by Bruce, and finally Bret would accept the match, and he would wrestle Bruce at WrestleMania. But Bret convinced them that Owen was the better choice, and the rest is history. Matt from Detroit, with one of the toughest buy or sells I think I've ever done here on this show. The Wrestling Observer, he says, has only given 5 5-star matches in WWE history. Of the 5, 2 were in 1994, 2 were in 1997, and 1 was in 2011, which I think was the Punk Cena match at Money in the Bank. So I ask, of the 2 years that had a pair of 5-star matches, which pair was better? 94 with the Shawn Razor ladder match and WrestleMania 10 match with Bret and Owen. And by the way, I screwed that up. WrestleMania 10 was Shawn and Razor. He meant the cage match with Bret and Owen at SummerSlam. Or 1997 with the Bret Hart, Steve Austin submission match at WrestleMania 13 and Shawn Michaels, Undertaker, Hell in a Cell at Bad Blood. And that is a tough one, and it's tough because those are 4 of the best matches in WWE history that he just named right there. The Shawn Razor ladder match, you know, it's become this legendary thing. It stands on its own, and it kind of set the trend for all the ladder matches that came after it and all the crazy stuff that we see today. That match, to me, I've watched that match in recent years. It holds up. I mean, yeah, you don't have a lot of the flips and crazy moves that we see now, but I think it still holds up. I think one of the more brutal spots in that whole thing is when Shawn just picks the whole ladder up and throws it halfway across the ring. It hits Razor right in the lower back. I still cringe when I watch that. So that match has stood the test of time. Bret and Owen, you guys know this if you've listened to this podcast for any length of time. That cage match from SummerSlam that year is my favorite steel cage match ever in WWE. Having said all of that, I am going to buy on the 2 matches from 1997. I'm going to sell on the 2 from 1994. And here's why. Those 2 matches from 1997, standing on their own, okay, just the matches themselves, are fantastic. But they also helped launch 2 careers. The submission match with Bret helped make Steve Austin's career as a babyface. It started him on that ascent. It solidified him as the guy in the company for many years to come, and he went on to become one of the biggest names of all time. It also helped turn Bret Hart into a money heel. Bret had been there for how many years? And had all those great matches and feuds with Lawler and Owen and all these people. But I don't know that Bret was ever really, like, was Bret ever really looked at as like a money, like a top money guy until the anti-American stuff in 1997? I don't know. I mean, he helped carry the company on his back through the whole New Generation thing, him and Shawn. Without Bret, they would have been in far more trouble than they were in. Bret was very, very popular, especially like 94. I'm not denying any of that. I was the bit. Look, Bret Hart's my favorite of all time. I've said that before. But I don't know that Bret was ever really looked at as like a money guy, like a top guy until 97. And he was much older. And obviously that was his last year with the company, as it turned out. But he turned out some of his best work, especially on the microphone that year. And it really, you know, that submission match wasn't the start of it. Bret was already teasing, you know, he was whining and talking about being screwed going all the way back to like December. So it wasn't like it started with the submission match, but that match, they did the double turn, right? Bret went heel, Austin went babyface. It's maybe the best double turn that they've ever pulled off in history. And it was fantastic. And I would say that 97 was Bret Hart's best overall year as a performer, in my opinion. As much as I love his matches from that 92 to 94 period, as a complete performer, I think 1997 anti-American Bret Hart, who gets booed in the US and cheered everywhere else, is the best Bret Hart. So that match was huge. Then you have the Hell in a Cell match. Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker, already two made men, two main eventers already, but you have the debut of Kane, which I still say is the best debut of a new character in WWE history. They built that story up for months. Kane is alive! Your brother is alive! They kept teasing it and teasing it and teasing it. And I can only imagine all the different... And the reason they probably kept dragging it out was probably they kept changing different concepts and ideas, or maybe the look of the character. Well, all I know is that when he finally made his debut and he walked out there on night number one... they made a new star. The look, the mask, the entrance, the music, him ripping the door off its hinges, him laying out The Undertaker with a tombstone, they made in one night a new main event heel. And 20 years later, Kane is still around. Now, maybe not while he's running for office, but he's still there all these years later. That's how important those two matches were in 1997, not just to the people involved, but to the careers of at least, you know, one or two other people as well. So that's really why I'm buying on those two over the ones from 94. But I encourage everybody with an earshot here to go on the network and watch all four of them. Watch all four back to back to back to back, and then tell me which one you think was the best. But go back and watch all four of them, because they're four of the best matches you'll ever see. And if you are a newer WWE fan and all you're familiar with is stuff from the last like 3 years or 5 years, you're in for a treat if you've never seen these matches before. So that's going to do it for the mailbag. We'll wrap things up here. We'll get back to more of your questions next week. Keep sending them in, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please follow me on Twitter, @solomonster is my handle. Take advantage of our Audible offer. We are in the middle of our best month ever. audibletrial.com/solomonster. Get yourself the new AJ Lee book. Again, I believe the Justin Roberts book is due to drop there any day now, so take advantage. Every time you sign up with our link, you're helping the podcast out, and you get one free book out of it. I am planning on doing a payback review later tonight, so you'll want to tune into the YouTube channel, and as soon as that goes up, you'll be the first to know. And remember, whenever I do these reviews, you can always find a link. If you want to download or stream the MP3 and not be bothered with YouTube, or you have a data cap and you're worried about that when you're not on Wi-Fi, that's fine. There's always a link to the MP3 in the video description, so you have to go to the video. But go in the description, you'll find the link, and you can download it and listen that way. We'll be back next weekend for episode 494 on our March to 500. Enjoy Payback tonight. I am the Solomonster. I will be back with you next weekend, so until then, be well, stay safe. And I will see you guys right back here next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Sala Monster sounds off.
If WWE were a person, how would you describe them? It's just a very bizarre question. But these are the different options they gave as passionate, talented, funny, modest, except for all those did-you-know facts they pepper us with every single week. Kind, cheerful, sweet, surprising, adventurous, flexible. How the fuck can an organization be flexible? This is a real survey question here. You would think you were going on a date. I have no interest in dating WWE. They're clingy, they're painfully unfunny, and all they do is talk about themselves. They're not my type.
The Monster sounds off.
Since 2007, The Sala Monster sounds off. Available at thesalamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solo Monsters sound off.